You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Unintelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, logging to the fourth world from aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com and ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And you have tuned in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliberal, neo-fascist, and misogynist control. I wish to welcome you all to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. Shout out to the gods and earth, and peace to the original family at this time in strife and struggle. This is the Angry Indian, and today we'll be speaking to an activist that you should know about, especially if you're in the African community. And we can sit and talk about the crime gene. Or, you know, we can talk and, you know, we can be like Mathus and Nelson Rockefeller, and we can sit here and talk about what is genetically wrong with people, that they are poverty prone, that they are antisocial, you know, prone to violence and what have you. We can do that. And I'm sure that to some degree there is some scientific validity, at least into understanding how that works out. But, you know, we have a habit, instead of looking at what elements in the society, what elements in the extant ruling class, because all of these societies have classes, brothers and sisters. We have to wake up. Even in the United States, it likes to pretend that there is no such thing as class. Class here is a dirty word. But, you know, in the end, whether it's stop and frisk, whether it's, you know, slave lease, right, that they came around after the official slave period here, you know, whether it's wage slavery, which is what most of us are dealing with, but we're talking about people who are stuck in economic hell, social hell, legal hell. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, brothers and sisters, when you talk about the United States being founded on democracy, freedom, and universal. That wasn't true. Women here were not allowed to vote until what? Just about the 1920s. And the reason that they got the right to vote was by basically shaming the white male population here by saying that they gave, in some states in the South, black men the right to vote. So we have a lot of contradictions, and we don't talk about the prison population, and we don't talk about the fact that before the European came here, which is not to say that indigenous societies in the United States or what became the United States were perfect. You know, I am the first here to tell you that that is not true, that that is a fantasy, that in itself is a form of, you know, racism. To say that, well, you know, it was some sort of a purity, and before the European came, that there was absolutely no malfeasance, no social problems. Of course there were. We dealt with them differently. And you have to understand something else. You know, because what I was going to launch into is that there were no prisons in North America before the European came here. There were differing ways. And besides, we had societies that didn't deal with greed and material wealth the way we have learned. Now, I said all of that to say this, is that the people who tend to be on the bottom of the society, you know, if they're not, you know, literal slaves, they're working it as slave labor for the state. For the people who own the state, they find many, many ways to shovel people into these hellholes. And we see what's happening in the United States, where incarceration is now become a profit industry, which it always has been to some degree. But there's no stopping it now. And it's full bore. And the same American companies, Wack and Hut is one. They are now doing this in the United Kingdom. They are now privatizing prisons in Australia. They are privatizing prisons in New Zealand. Okay, so today we have a guest. We're going to be speaking to Darcie Della Prosa from the UK. She's an Irish activist living in the UK, but she does a lot of advocacy work and a lot of in-your-face, on-point activism dealing with crime and punishment in the United States. Now, we talk a lot here about injustice, and when it came to the Troy Anthony Davis case, Troy Anthony Davis execution, Troy Anthony Davis state murder, you can call it what you want. You know, the bottom line was this was someone who turned himself into the authorities because he knew that he was innocent. We have in this case, well, I'm not going to name him because, you know, it's all speculative, but someone who we all know by name, who has admitted to doing what Troy Anthony Davis was executed for. Now, we remember the night that he died. The Black Congressional Caucus came through at the very last minute. There were some, you know, people like Dead Prez and what have you were always on that case. We didn't hear too much from the superstars of the black entertainment world, since they seem to be the only people that anyone wants to listen to. It was making the activist community, in the African community, in the United States, in the international community, we were all beside ourselves because we were looking at someone of which there was no physical evidence, there was no eyewitness testimony that could be believed. I mean, the majority of these people recanted their story. They said that they were forced to testify against this man. You know, there was a lot of frustration here. And I want to say something, and you know, if people get upset about this, then that's just too bad. But you know, some of the most fervent activism for in favor of Leonard Peltier, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Dudley George, if you remember that case, Troy Anthony Davis, of course, that we're speaking about now, in terms of police brutality, Oscar Grant. I'm not saying that there wasn't voices here in the United States, Sean Bell. I'm not saying Derek Jones. I'm not saying that there were not people here, not just in the African community, but in the United States in general, who were not upset, that did not protest, that did not march, that did not hold their rallies. It did happen. But the analysis was not there. The commitment to activism in the sense of this is not just a case about a particular individual, that we're looking at a paradigm, we're looking at a system of injustice, we're looking at an imbalance of justice. It wasn't there. And this is where Ms. Della Prosa comes in, because she is one of these activists that I'm speaking about, that they can see the United States for what it is. You know, with those of us who really want to believe that there's going to be some kind of a justice under this president, which is what everybody voted for, we're not really understanding that majority of what I just spoke about happened under his watch. And we have not been really putting, you know, our asses in gear in terms of staying on these cases and making sure that these cases are followed through, that the authorities follow through. There are so many things that I can list here and that we will list, but I want to introduce you all to Ms. Darcie Della Prosa. As I may have mentioned already, she is Irish-born but lives and works in the UK, and she does a hell of a lot of international work in terms of crime and punishment. I believe she works with juveniles at risk in the UK. So we're talking about somebody that's extremely committed for the long term, for the long haul. And I would like to, for all of you, to start checking out her work. She's really out there. She's doing some serious activism. And you can find her work at least one of her blogs, Irish Green Eyes. That's one word. Irish Green Eyes - Welcome to My World. Again, one word. .blogspot.com. And I've said enough. So, Ms. Darcie Della Prosa, welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Hi. I'd like to say something about what you were saying about Troy Davis.
Sure.
I know you couldn't mention the other person, but I remember the night in question when they executed him. I remember I went to a vigil And I remember when they were giving him stay that night, and everyone always thought it'd be a week, a month, whatever. But they gave him an hour. They kept him on the gurney before they executed him. And the sad thing about it, if you gave the two issues of the other person in question, which, as you said, we won't mention no names, Troy Davies maintained his innocence for 20 years. The other person confessed, was a confessed murderer. On Troy's case, there was no physical evidence. The other person's death sentence was commuted to life without parole. Where's the justice there, without being biased? And when I look at, there was 1 million people around the world that signed that petition for clemency for Troy Davies, but yet they still executed him. If people used to say to me, no, they would never execute Troy Davies because basically they would look at, he would be a martyr. I think it shocked so many people around the world that night they executed Troy Davies, and yet they gave basically a pardon to a convicted murderer. And I've always sat back and said, I was so angry that night. And that's what made me more... Another reason why I came away from the death penalty, because I couldn't sit back and watch the innocent people that they were executing. That's why I got more involved in what I do now with juveniles. But then saying that, even with the juveniles, a lot of the juveniles I deal with, their sentences are still like life without parole. It's still a death sentence.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there. I don't know how many of these men have are still surviving, but you know, there were many accounts. 60 mm-hmm. Minutes here, CBS did a story many years ago on how many men who were picked up for purely racist reasons in the American South and in the American Northeast in the late 50s, 60s, 70s, who they knew were innocent. But they had been, they held them for so long, you know, wife, if they had one, had passed on, family gone, you know, all their relations, everyone they knew gone. Many of these men were not even educated before they were incarcerated. So they showed a few of these men. I mean, they were very bent and gray, and they had, you know, gardening duties and what have you. But they said, well, we can't let them go because there's nothing to let them go to. So we just take care of them. You know, this is the attitude that has always been in the United States. So, you know, as someone from the UK, where the laws are somewhat different, and, you know, now in the case of Julian Assange, we have, you know, this recent case of Julian Assange, we have the question of extradition from the EU and the UK attitude about whether or not it is a full member of the EU. And, you know, there's another case of a... Not similar, it's actually quite different, but it's a sexual charge. This man was already convicted in an American court, and the UK is not extraditing him because they believe that he will be put into torturous conditions from what they understand, where he would be held and what have you. You know, this hypocrisy in terms of how the law is applied and who is applied to and under what circumstances.
Another case, if you, Linda Carty, where the UK didn't step in sooner, where they will execute Linda Carty. That was another case in Texas, Texas grandmother. Clive Stafford has done so much work campaigning for her reprieve. But this is another case where the UK did nothing. I'm sorry, I did have to get that in.
Oh, no, that's fine. I mean, you know, I'm not aware of all of these cases. I mean, you know, I do try to keep up with some of the more famous cases. And I hate to say it like that, but that's pretty much what it is. You know, usually because a celebrity or a well-respected politician will take an interest in a particular case. But, you know, Mumia Abu-Jamal is somewhat difficult not to know about that case. You really have to have blinders on to know nothing at all about that case and that there are questions surrounding that case. We also have Lenny Peltier. You know, we know about these cases because there was, you know, very massive political weight attached to what, you know, on the individuals involved. In the cases of, say, Devon Sanford or, say, like Trayvon Martin here in the United States. I mean, you know, the main reason that case is an issue, and it became an issue later, is because of activists like you in not just the African community here, but, you know, in the activist, milieu, for lack of a better term, in the United States, that felt that it was an injustice. They kept up the pressure online, and they ended up, you know, leading to the prosecution of George Zimmerman for shooting Trayvon Martin. So, you know, in terms of public power in a democracy, in terms of media and access to media, where can or where is the activist to start to think in terms of 5-10 years down the road, in terms of addressing the social issues that we know the ruling classes, the elected leadership, you know, I mean, they're simply not dealing with. Capitalism is not dealing with.
If you wanted to, you could put name after name after name of injustices. Yep, you're right, you've got Mumia, you've got, I can't even think off the top of my head now because there's so many which I advocate for, I'm a voice for, like so many, but until people literally make a stand and say enough is enough, let's do more, and as I've always maintained, and I still say up to this day, to be that voice for these people, because that's what you are. A lot of these people that are incarcerated, they put their trust in you because they're not in the free world. So, like a lot of the cases I highlight, like Devontae Sanford, Devontae's case is, wow, it's like, how can I put it? It's like a stack of dominoes. When this case opens up, this will be the whole of Detroit that will basically, between the judge, the police, you name it, they have the person smothered, they have testimonies, they have statements, but yet they still will not release him. And I always say, why? This is an innocent child that has lost so many years of his life. He's not going to get back like a lot of people, but the difference is, why will they not release them? And I will keep maintaining that, and I will keep being a voice for that, and I will keep putting it out, like a lot of other cases. But this is one case that I took to heart. I even went to Detroit. That's how much this case means to me, because I became very close to his family. And I've read the evidence. I could read it off the top of my head. We've made this case so global around the world, but yet this child is still locked up. And why?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many that are in these situations. I was at someone's home. They were watching television, and there was a comedy show. I suppose it was a cable show, and it was a comedian that was performing to a group of women who were incarcerated, and they spoke to some of these women as this thing was ending, which is pretty much after I came in, and this woman said that she was with her boyfriend at the time, who didn't tell her that he was going to do a robbery of the store that they were in, the convenience store. He had a record for several of these things already. She just happened to be with him. You know, they got, you know, I mean, you know, the police showed up like right away. He got 2 years, she got 9.
Wow.
You know, they're both African. She didn't have a record. And, you know, it's like, where's the justice in this? And then we look at Wall Street, right? We look at Fleet Street. We look at what's happening in the Irish economy. We look at what's happening in Spain and in Greece and the rest of this. And we know that the crime rate is going to go up, that the aggression on the streets is going to go up, that the tension in the households is going to go up because of this. And, you know, a lot of us are not relating this into how this works out in terms of criminal justice. And that it's easy to say, okay, we need to prosecute, we need to put people away who are dangerous and what have you. But how do we get to these points? And where does, you know, our activism come into, in terms of educating the public about, you know, how we got ourselves in these situations to begin with, where we even need to talk about expanding incarceration, expanding the justice system, and expanding police powers and everything that comes along with it.
Well, I always say, there's so much corruption, like with NYPD. There's so much corruption with the government. There's, I say today, like now, there's a lot of musicians. I know you disagree to an extent on this one, but I find a lot of the hip hop artists now are taking up activism. They're being a voice. I know a person, he's from New York, his name's Billy Banks. He does a lot for justice. There's another one, DS, they do a lot for stop and frisk. Mm-hmm. When you are getting people like that involved, then you will see the media is starting to like say, wow, these people are like making a stand. They are like putting this out global, and that's what needs to be done. Back to the 60s, if you wanted to go back like on civil rights, it used to be like people went back on racism. It went back no dogs, no blacks, no Irish. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people forget, if they go back and do their history, like you go back, there's always history. As I always say, there's always a paper trail. Go study, go back, read up. I could go on and on and on. I've learned, because when I started off as an activist about 7 or 8 years ago, I started off like with Death Row. I supported Mumia, I supported Troy Davis, Chip Fitzgerald, and then in, I think it was 2009, a friend of mine, her husband, was executed, and it made me feel I had to walk away because I was too emotionally involved in what I was doing, and I was thinking, at the time, going back 7 years, there wasn't many people, I could count on my fingers, of activists that really dealt with juveniles. Mm-hmm. And I became very close with a good few of them that came originally from MySpace, and I do a lot of work with them now. I have a good friend, Steve, at the moment. He's down in, I can't exactly say exactly where, but he's dealing with a child at the moment who's 14. They've just given him a sentence, like a life sentence. There was no evidence. And a lot of these cases with the juveniles, you imagine at 9 and 8 years of age being given a life sentence. These kids are like, their brain hasn't even functioned. And they people are basically like just throwing them away. Where I always think in the States, they have all this money, they're building all these prisons. And I think, why don't you put it into to use, programs to help these kids before they deteriorate, because a lot of people don't even look at their background, like Sarah Cousin. Sarah's case, she did have a good background, Katona Brown. A lot of people judge these kids without looking and saying, well, hold on, there must be a reason. A child like doesn't just kill, a child does not become evil. They have to look at kids, that the background of these children, and they don't. They're just so easy, quick to judge these children. And I think it's so wrong, because children are meant to be our future. But what future, or what, how can I put it? What goal are we setting for these kids? We are meant to be the adults here, the teachers. We are meant to be saying, this is our future. Let's try and break the cycle. Not just lock them up, because you're locking these kids up, but, or trying and kids are adults, and they're losing like half their life. When they come out, they're basically broken people. What is out there for them? There's no jobs for them. There's no, they might have got an education, but when they come out, is there a second chance for them? Hell no.
And for young black men in the United States, stop and frisk has ruined a lot of lives, because
exactly.
many people have lost their jobs, and I've heard case after case after case, you know, simply for being late because of these regular routine stops. And if they take them in, that follows them their whole life, and you know, there's the background check now for everything, and
exactly.
Yeah, you know, travel, you know, and anything. And so even if somebody is, this is, you know, say for sake of argument, you know, a bad seed, if they do manage to reform themselves, and you and I both have known people that have managed to turn their lives around. You know, when someone showed some care and some interest in, you know, giving them a hand instead of a slap, you know.
Exactly.
You know, they usually ended up being some of the better citizens because they remember what it was like not to have. We're going to take a break right now. We're speaking to Darcy De La Presseur in the UK. We're talking about crime and punishment. And, you know, this relation to capitalism and the types of societies that capitalism develops. You know, I don't want to speak for Ms. De La Presseur, you know, and I'm not advocating any particular system, but when you have something like this, more than 90% of the world is capitalist, and more than 90% of the world is dealing with what we're discussing here. So that just kind of says something about capitalism, don't you think? This is the Angry Indian, and you are listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Internet radio for smarter Aboriginals.
A black co-worker and I were driving up Grand River, which is a major artery in Detroit. And we're about to turn left onto Joy Road when all of a sudden we realized that this convoy of state police cars had made a U-turn and were pulling us over. So I came out of the car with my hands up, and what I saw was I was circled by people with long guns and pistols, and they were all pointing at me, and they were all nervous people. They were all white, and I'm a black guy, and I'm a high government official, but I was a nigger in white America, and I thought at that moment I was going to be dead, 35 years old and dead at the corner of Joy Road and Grand River.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Talk radio for the fourth world.
When the Creator gave us this land to live on, there was no white man on this island, for he was across the ocean. That's where his patriot, not here in this land.
Hablarían para los pueblos originales. Está escuchando usted Radio Anglia.
On est parlé pendant des peuples originaires. Vous écoutez Radio Anglia. Anglia-Indian Radio.blogspot.com.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio.
So this is Troy Anthony Davis, and I've been sitting on George's death row for 16 years for a crime I did not commit. In a struggle for me and my family, as well as the victim's family, who I sympathize with, really, because they have been cheated out of justice just as I have. They deserve justice more than anyone deserves justice. Because of Amnesty's assistance as well as Arnold and Porter, you know, I'm still sitting here alive today being able to have a conversation. And I want to thank all Amnesty supporters, you know, all the volunteer workers. I want to thank everyone all over the world, you know, who has been praying for me, supporting me, writing letters and signing petitions and things like that. I want to encourage you to continue to sign the Amnesty petitions, continue to write letters and look into my situation. Because this situation could have happened to anyone, but it needs to start with me. It needs to continue to let their voice be heard, because if their voice has not been heard thus far, the parole board probably would have went ahead and let me be executed. know, my faith in God all these years has kept me strong. Because in any other situation, had I not had God in my life and a strong family support base, you know, I would have been giving up. You know, there's a couple of guys back here that dropping their pills and saying, you know, they'd rather go ahead and be executed than spend the rest of their life in prison. And with me, because I have faith that God will eventually intervene to set things right, you know, it kept me strong. It gave me hope. You should never be able to convict a man or even indict a person, man or woman, without any physical evidence, no whatsoever. I will never take another human being's life. And this killer is still out there. My family's in mourning. The victim's family's in mourning. And the truth is still locked in because I didn't get justice. But in DNA cases, you know, that's physical evidence that you can test. I have no physical evidence to test to prove my innocence. But when these witnesses volunteered to come forth because their conscience was bothering them about the lies that they told on me, when they came forth and signed these affidavits, then that was evidence for me to test. When they took me to that death cell for death watch 24 hours before the execution, you know, it really affected me and everybody on death row, because you had grown men crying because they've heard about my situation. They know it. And they was like, they said, if I couldn't get no justice, nobody could get justice.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA. तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो
थाहा छ सन् 1988 मा
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए कसले के गरे
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी वहन गर्यौं तपाईले गर्नुभयो
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं जिम्मेवारी वहन गरौं
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास
Danza toya kakio ni wakuma akantik. Winston Wataninia, Miksuachi, Saskatchewan, the Ocean.
I am Winston Watini. I am from Saskatchewan. Knowledge is power. We must gather knowledge to protect our children, our culture, our future. Learn the ways you can protect yourself and others from infection and spreading HIV. Teach others what you have learned. Together, we can make a difference.
This is Howard Zinn. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced false news reports, imprisoned without charge, and tortured, targeted civilians, and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Hello, this is Maurice Muhammad, Minister of Reformation with Black Unity, and you can always find us at www.blackunity.ning.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginals.
C'était intelligent de radio.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Non-Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. You know, as you guys know, this is the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service. And you can find our main site at aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com. Our official newswire can be found at ang-newswire.blogspot.com. Yeah, if you have a community-focused nonprofit PSA, grassroots news item, or anything else that you think Indigenous people should know about, drop us a line at aboriginalradio@lavabit.com. you know, we're back. We're back with Ms. Darcy De La Prosa, and we're talking about, again, crime and punishment. And as activists, you know, a lot of us, okay, you know, we're into marching, and we're into, you know, standing and you know, doing the soapbox thing. But that doesn't really seem to be working. In terms of the legal route, what are the best avenues for activists? There's the ACLU, there's other legal groups. You have the Innocence Project.
You have Color.org.
Yeah. I mean, of course, and then there's the usual stars, right? Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. You know, how do we start to use the legal process internationally, not just locally, for some of these cases? Because they are violating international law. Well, what are your suggestions for activists in terms of bringing these cases to that level?
I swear by MySpace, Twitter, Facebook, Scoop, Blog Talk Radio, Black Talk Radio, Freeway Enterprise, and the list goes on and on. But that is the best place, if you are an activist, is to use the tool of the internet. That is how I've got my stories global. Devontae Stanford, Leon Benson, Terrence Bowen, Sarah Cruzan, I had a few more. But the best way is, as I've always maintained, is to be that voice for these people, is use the internet. Because that is a stage. If, like on Twitter, I also have on Twitter, it's like a global newspaper where you have your followers, if it's like NBC News, Channel 7, all them, they're all connected, so they pick up on these stories. And that is the way forward as an activist.
Well, I mean, yeah, you're right. But I mean, in terms of the international, in terms of international law, in terms of access to medical care, access to, you know, adequate and objective legal representation. You know, I mean, most of these things are being ignored. We have a constitution in the United States that's technically being ignored. You know,
a lot of them are being ignored. Rights. You don't have rights. What do they say? Land of the free, land of the incarcerated. And it took me a long time to understand what that quote meant. I realised through a lot of the work I'd done. But I met some amazing teachers online. The Grey Hair Project that dealt with the Scott sisters. And these are people that campaigned like major on Facebook, MySpace, putting these stories out. I remember the night when the Scott sisters were free. It was like, I remember putting this speech out on every one of my network. If you are not a true activist, you will never understand. We made history tonight. And it was like, wow, this little person from the UK was putting this statement out. Because it was amazing to watch these two girls that basically got life for, I think it was for $25. And I remember at the time, Hailey Barber, they were campaign after campaign and they refused to release them. But I think because they got so much media coverage and they got a lot with Nancy Lockhart, the Grey Hair Project, name after name you can say that went with these cases. But there was a clause when the Scott sisters came out, and it was like a human rights issue that if one of the sisters released, she had to donate her kidney at mm-hmm. the time.
Yeah.
And I remember it was big global news, and then all of a sudden it died down. It's like a lot of these cases, they're big cases when they're highlighted in the news. It's like when they're released, it's like they're just forgotten. And there was one question about that that's always got me. It's like even now. Sometimes, like with Chip Fitzgerald, he's another long extending prisoner, like from one of the Black Panthers. And like his story, unless it's like he's up in the news, and no one puts his name out there.
Yeah, I mean, Troy Anthony Davis, I don't hear too many people talk about him too much either.
They don't, because he's forgotten. Maybe come this sometime this year, when it's like the anniversary has been, it's good for a year, you'll get people that will put a memorial candle out. And it's sad, because these people, like Troy Davis, he was basically, to me, he was someone that I campaigned for day one. I can give a few names that campaigned for him. And to see that they took his life, that he was innocent, is so sad.
Yeah, I mean, all of these cases get me. You know, the names I can remember, honestly. Sean Bell. Yeah, I remember that one primarily because he was getting married that morning. Derek Jones, I remember mostly, and I'm being honest about this, because Ayanna Jones, you know, the two names, you know, I remember them because I was just so disgusted about what happened with her. Devontae Sanford, you know, I mean, I know about that one and it's in my mind. Same thing with Trayvon Martin, because I've seen it, you know, again and again, you know, in the news. It was mentioned on, you know, on Twitter and what have you. This level of forgetfulness, this sense of social apathy for our fellow man, how would you define that? How would you analyze that in terms of this overwhelming flood of media? Because it's not information, you know, it's just media. And even though the world is really shrinking, it's become much more cosmopolitan, you know, much more than it was. Not just because of the internet, but in large part. Yeah, and you know, given all of that, you know, how do we explain in our activism, you know, as we're trying to analyze what we're doing and what's the best solution for the most people in a short term, the rights of the individual. You know, how do we deal with this in the 21st century, where things are becoming in many, many ways much more narrow in terms of how people are dealing with each other on the civil level, on how we're looking at things in terms of imperialism, in terms of war, in terms of war profiteering, in terms of exploitation, in terms of how exploitation goes from the lower levels in terms of class exploitation into exploitation in the home, exploitation within the community, within the church even, or the mosque, you know, any of these religious organizations. You know, the day-to-day sense of permissible abuse, I suppose, and how that relates to everything we've been talking about this evening.
People need to come together more in communities. Yes, the church needs to come more in communities. I met a great person. His name's Pastor Omar Wilkes. He does so much for Alana Jones. If I can say this, I'm not plugging what I'm doing, but every Monday we do a call-in up until the 30th. Well, that's mostly with Devontae's case and I'm dealing and Alana Jones. But we're making people aware of these cases of justice, because Alana Jones, her case should never be forgotten. There's catastrophe now at the moment because of her father, Charles Jones, at the moment. If you go on to Facebook, you can check out Pastor Omar, what he's doing with Alana Jones' case. Because this is one case I will push that needs to be kept in the media, same as Devontae and so many more.
As activists, you know, one of the complaints I made as we came into the show was that there's not enough analysis. You know, there's a lot of marching, there's a lot of talk of marching, there's not enough analysis, there's not enough sit down, you know, we sit down at the table and say, okay, what are we going to do? You know, the law is already in place.
The law is already in place, yes, I agree. You can have rally after rally, but, sorry. This is what you call when you live in London.
What, are they watching the game?
Yeah, they're watching the football.
Yeah, I'll look at
the scores. I live right in central London, so you hear everything.
I'll look at the scores when we're done.
But I will say at this point, on this interview, that as a true activist, I just say, be that voice for the voiceless. Stand up, be counted. seek justice, but to seek justice, use every tool you can find. Journalism is more powerful than a gun, because you have that voice, you have that right, that person to say, right, this person deserves his freedom, or basically, without waffling on, just be you, just stand up for what you believe in.
I was, you know, looking for a little bit more of a direct answer in terms of international law, because, you know, these laws are there. And see, one of my arguments is, you know, I'm fine with the marching and, you know, the rallies. That's all cool. But we have laws on the books. You have the nation's laws. In terms of the United States, you have state, you have federal, you have constitutional. You also have, you know, international law. So, you know, where do we go in terms of utilizing these particular tools?
Well, these particular tools, I can say, I'm not a paralegal, I'm not a lawyer. I am just a voice, an expert. And that I will say, most of the United States law is the biggest mockery going, the same as the United Kingdom. But in the state, I just think it's barbaric. The laws, how they treat people, they treat kids, they treat their people out there.
It's something that we need to work on, and it does
show. And I will always be a pain, because I will keep putting out their dirty laundry, basically.
Yeah, and there's plenty.
Trust me, there is.
You know, there's plenty, and it's universal. I mean, what's going on, well, at least what we thought was going to be going on in this wave of you know, the Arab Spring and Occupy and what have you. And the revelations from WikiLeaks, you know, you really would have thought that they would have been a little bit more of a, you know, what I would like to see personally, an intellectual sea change.
Exactly.
You know, so that, you know, when we get our heads together and really understand what's, you know, what's happening. And this is why I mentioned international law and the laws that are already on the books, you know, and the sense of morality that the West claims to uphold. You know, I'm saying that instead of just saying that it's bad, that one of the things that we need to do is actually focus on these contradictions, you know, to focus on that hypocrisy. And believe me, I think that's one of the things that you do in your work. And it's been lovely speaking with you, Ms. De La Prosa.
Thank you.
You know, we've been speaking with Ms. Darcy De La Prosa from the UK, and you can find her work online and get a pen, because it's... it's a little long, and I don't want anyone to be confused. It's Irish Green Eyes - Welcome to My World. Let me say that again. Irish Green Eyes, one word, - Welcome to My World, one word, .blogspot.com. And, you know, see what she's doing in terms of the human rights issue, because that's what this is, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, and the conservative lurkers who hang out here to see what we have to say. You know, we're talking about human justice, and, you know, to have so many people, so many of our young people, I mean, so many of our young folks, if they're not on a battlefield, they're in prison. But who's in school? Where are the lawyers? Where are the scientists? Where are the doctors? You know, we look at an example like Cuba, which is not capitalist. They have more doctors, more teachers, more educators, more artists. They have more people dealing on the social end of life. And as tough as things are, they're living life. They're enjoying life. Here, we're basically caught in a cycle of insanity. And, you know, it's really too much. And as sometimes, it usually takes someone from outside of that system, from outside of where you are, to be able to articulate things for you with a different viewpoint. And that's where Ms. De La Prosa comes in. She, again, is from the UK, does a lot of this work dealing with the injustices in the United States system. And I really hope you check out her work. This has been Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. I hope you learned something. I know I did. Good night.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. I want to talk a little bit generally, then I want to talk about my men. The most serious political weakness that continues to subdue, divide, and disorganize and make the Afro-American people dependent on their enemies is the lack of a permanent national, democratically elected political organization, a representative assembly, a permanent congressional or parliamentary-like institution.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And the Democrats are throwing the election away. For what? An inadequate black male who would not have been running had it not been a white woman that was running for president. I'm no second-class citizen. And goddamn the Democrats.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Was the incident for which you're charged now, was it a revolutionary act on your part?
You asking me to confess to something?
As an assassin. Unless you want to, did you kill the man?
Look, one of the most important elements of guerrilla warfare is maintain secrecy. I've killed nobody until, it's been proven, and they'll never be able to prove anything like that.
The psychological effect of our secret army, the real destructive effect it can have, an increasingly pervasive underground press with emphasis on a mass style, the popularization of the revolutionary culture and then the elevating of it, both under the direction of an ultra-aggressive political party. These three, with no element missing, connected to the realistic issues, form the basis of our only hope. There will be no educating, no consciousness, no revolutionary culture, no forward movement without these three elements working with the harmony of a healthy organism. George Jackson, 1971.
From the Diamond District to your CD player.
Radio.
The original mixtape radio show.
The mixtape as emancipatory journalist.
Check it out right here.
The principal reservoir of revolutionary potential in America lies in wait inside the black colony. Its sheer numerical strength, its desperate historical relation to the violence of the productive system, and the fact of its present status and the creation of wealth forced the black stratum at the base of the whole class structure into the forefront of any revolutionary scheme. 30% of all industrial workers are black. Close to 40% of all industrial support roles are filled by blacks. Blacks are still doing the work of the greatest slave state in history. The terms of our servitude are all that have been altered. George Jackson, 1971.
The origins of the police force need to be understood. The police force in this country really began, one, in the South, during slavery, where people, you know, you gotta understand, most white folks in the South did not own anybody.
Right.
Du Bois said 7% of the white South owned 76% of the enslaved African population. So that means the majority of whites, he said like 5 million whites owned nobody, meaning that most white folks in the South were just poor, peasant,
right,
disenfranchised groups. So it was out of this community that the elite whites selected poor whites to patrol to catch the escaped property, which is us. So that's the first origin of the police force, all right, that we have to understand. And in the North, it has a similar origin. In the North, the police force begins with corporate owners paying off private security groups to police and break up unions and labor organizing. So the police in this country, North or South,